following program may contain traces of irony, sarcasm, satire, parody, mockery, banter, caricature, and nuts. The opinions expressed are almost certainly not shared by self-appointed officious dictatorial wowsers. If you are dangerously irony deficient or allergic to mockery of the self-important and corrupt, then get a life.
Yes, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to another episode of Environmental as Anything, the place where we get a life, or at least we stand up for the life here on our Mother Earth. And in all throughout the universe, for that matter, wherever it may be found, which, you know, at this point, obviously, still just here on Mother Earth. So, all life in the universe, our remit, I should say thank you, respects to elders past, present and emerging of the Bundjalung Nation, where I live, work and play. This is stolen land, always was and always will be the property of the Bundjalung people. So here we are. I've got a huge show, as always say, and it's always true. We've got a huge show lined up today. We've got Subi Awad, who is going to be talking to us about the Suraya sales for Gaza. And there's this courageous group of people who are sailing to Gaza from around the world. There's a flotilla of people taking supplies to the people in crisis in the Gaza. So that's the Freedom Flotilla Coalition, made up of 30 countries and hundreds of participants. And there's Suraya, who is I hope I've got the pronunciation right there, but who's from the Northern Rivers region, is actually on that flotilla, and that'll be very interesting to hear their take on what is going on in Gaza and what can be done for the much maligned and terribly oppressed people of Palestine. I've got on the line very quickly at this late stage of the show, but very glad to have Subi, who has agreed to talk to us about the Freedom Flotilla. Subi, from Subi, thanks for joining Environmental as Anything today.
Thanks so much for having me on the show, Sean.
No, great
to be here.
No worries, mate. And there was a few hiccups along the way. Thank you for persisting with us. Look, can you explain to us what it is that, you're taking the Suraya Sail for Gaza campaign. So why is Suraya, who is Suraya, and why are they sailing for Gaza?
Well, Suraya's a local man. He's a care worker. He's an all-round great guy. And the terrible situation in Gaza. It's really like a terrible famine with starvation and a really awful situation for the people there. And so they are taking 5,500 tons of food and medicine to the people in Gaza who desperately need it. And it's a flotilla, so there's three ships going, and it's full of peace activists. So, you know, like unarmed, peaceful people who are doing their best to take aid over there to Gaza.
Wow. Well, that's such a noble calling, it sounds like. And it sounds, in light of recent events, that it could be quite dangerous. It sounds like the Israeli Defense Force have been targeting aid workers over there. Are we concerned about Suraya's safety on this epic journey?
We're really worried about Suraya's safety. As some of your listeners may well know, that an Australian aid worker was killed alongside seven other aid workers for the World Central Kitchen. The World Central Kitchen were pumping out 300,000 meals a day in a famine, and now wow, that's gone.
Mm.
So Israel purposely targeted them, over and over again until it got them all. And so what we're seeing now is this sort of act of mass starvation, and anyone who's getting in the way is in terrible danger. And so Suraya and his comrades are taking a big risk, a really huge risk. And I asked him, why are you doing this, Suraya? Please, like, it's really, really dangerous. He said, I can't bear it if no one goes. Mm. I people have to do this. There are literally people starving to death, watching their children starve to death. So we have to do this. And if not me, then who? And you know, you just got to salute someone with such a big heart. He's one of those people that believes we're all in it together. You know, we're not just islands and we're not just separate from each other. And you know, that people, if they're starving, we have to feed them. And really, Syria shouldn't be doing this. Our government should be doing this. Our government should be taking food to starving people. But because they're not, just everyday normal people have to do this. And it's a terrible shame that they have to risk their lives to do it.
Indeed, indeed. And that is courageous. The Freedom Flotilla Coalition, can you tell us a bit more about that?
Yeah, so they've been every year trying to take food and supplies to Gaza. And they are a really big collective from over 30 countries. And you know, these are great people. These are peace activists. These are, you know, when you see them talking, they're just everyday, you know, peaceful people who see something that is just terrible and they're just trying to do their best to fix it. Mm. It's not a sort of, you know, anarchist kind of like hardcore group of people. They're just like peace activists, basically, you know?
Mm. Yeah, yeah. So just interested in actually providing humanitarian resources, as you say, like it's 5,000 tons of, so how are they carrying all of that? What's the flotilla made up of?
Yes, so they've got a big, you know, a really big container ship, which is carrying most of the food and medicine. And then they've got a couple of other smaller ships, which are carrying most of the peace activists. Mm. So that's their three ships that are sailing.
Yep. And they've sailed from Australia, is that right? Or they've sailed from...
They've sailed from Istanbul in Turkey. Yeah, so it's not too far away. So it'll only take them a couple of days once they embark, and that should be really, really soon. So, you know, we'd really love everyone to, you know, follow their socials, Instagram and Facebook, and just the more people that are looking out for them, the more people that are watching them, the safer they'll be. So that's really a big deal for us. And that their Surya's campaign is Surya Sails for Gaza.
Mm. Okay, Surya Sails for Gaza. All right, I'm going to make a note of that so we can put it on the Environmental as Anything Facebook page.
Wonderful.
There is an event coming up, I understand, very soon. Is it today, this Saturday, you say?
Yeah, we've got an event today in Kingscliff, which is the spokesperson for the flotillas flying up to tell everyone about it. We're going to raise a little money for their campaign so we can hopefully get them out of there when they're done. And that's today. Next Saturday is the Palestinian Film Festival in Byron at the Community Theatre.
Right.
And that'll be a lovely day. We've got some great Palestinian movies and, you know, we'll have the Palestinian Fair Trade Store. We'll have great raffles. We've got an auction of some beautiful art, really, really stunning art. And, it's going to be a really lovely day in Byron Saturday.
Fantastic. So today in Kingscliff, there's a talk from one of the Freedom Flotilla organisers. Is that right?
Yeah, that's absolutely. What you said. In Kingscliff today.
Where is that and what time?
That's at the community hall in 6 o'clock. I'm actually halfway there. We just parked by the side of the road to do this interview with you.
Let you go to that as soon as possible. But quickly before you do, so next week, next Saturday, 1 week from today, Byron Bay Palestinian Film Festival. When and where?
So that's starting at 2:00. They've got multiple screenings. So you can get your tickets there from the community theatre. Or you can follow us. We're the Northern Rivers Friends of Palestine. That's on Facebook, or we're Northern Rivers for Palestine on Instagram, for the number 4. And you can find our group. We're really active here. We have lots of events. And, join in our group. We'll let you know about everything that's happening.
Well, look, Subi, thank you so much for the good work you're doing there. It's a horrific situation. We're all appalled to see what's going on in Palestine, but it's good to hear a glimmer of hope and a local person doing such good and courageous work for them.
Sean, and I love your show, love what it's about, and I really love your work too. And thank you so much for having me on the show.
Not a problem. Anytime. Let's stay in touch.
Thanks, mate.
Okay.
See ya.
Bye. And that was Subi Awad, who is supporting Surya Sales for Gaza, which is Surya Sales for Gaza. Go and look it up on your socials, Facebook, etc. And he's talking about the Palestinian Film Festival, 2 p.m. next week in Byron Bay. And, of course, today at the Kingscliff Community Centre, he was talking about speakers from the Flotilla for Freedom, speaking about that that terrific project to take much-needed food and medicines to the people of Gaza who are being starved out by the Israelis, and we'll hopefully see success for Surya and a safe return. Look, a lot going on in the world, of course, never can cover everything, but there's been a big nuclear push from Dudo and, you know, their latest in a line of non-policy solutions for our energy needs is this fantasy world suggestion that we're going to create and invent. We're going to invent this new technology that's going to become commercially viable before renewables can be rolled out. And that's the Liberal Party's response to the climate emergency is to go off with the pixies. Look, before we kick off the show, I often want to talk about some little personal reflections. And lately, I've had a bit of a lot of different bits of media cross my horizon, which were about the nuclear issue. I saw Oppenheimer recently, and that was eye-opening in itself. And I've seen I watched Doctor Strangelove again, which certainly brought things into sharp focus for me. It hasn't dated at all, despite being in black and white. It was a brilliant piece of filmmaking in its day, and it still tells the story brilliantly of the lunacy of the nuclear mutually assured destruction. And look, there's been lots of little bits and pieces. I watched the Fallout. The other night, the other day, I binged watched the whole series, which was a terrific, a bit of dramedy, a bit of comedy mixed in with the dark prospect of nuclear annihilation for the human race, and heard a piece that was a song list from Double J from 1983, which took me right back to the days when that threat of nuclear annihilation was foremost on all of our minds. Very surprising how many of those songs from that playlist were seriously protest songs. I doubt that if we looked at the 2023 equivalent, 40 years later, that we would find that there were as many, songs which were directly calling out for a change in our politics. Maybe I've just not been listening closely enough, but certainly back then in 1983, it was top of mind for a lot of people. And I've got to say, the turning point, it was a documentary series on Netflix. I don't often give a plug to things that I've been watching because I find it it can be a bit indulgent. But this has been absolutely eye-opening for me. Staggering facts about the turning point is subtitled The Cold War. The Bomb and the Cold War, I think it is. It's on Netflix. Go and look it up. Everybody should watch this documentary series. I think it's 9-part series. It's quite an extensive look into the whole of post-war history through the lens of the bomb and the Cold War. And I can tell you now, there's just every single episode has at least a couple of times has me gasping in horror at some of the facts that I was ignorant about. And one of them I'll let you know right now, share with you right now, is that did you know that the second H-bomb test in the world, the Americans carried out two H-bomb tests, or many H-bomb tests, but the second one that they carried out on the Bikini Atolls in the Pacific, and the unsuspecting populace of the Bikini Atolls, I should add, was 3 times larger than they expected it to be. Just let that sink in. the best scientists in the world, the smartest people in the world, reputedly, who had gone ahead and designed this mega bomb, and they were out by a factor of 3 times in their estimation of how big it would be. Instead of getting the 5 megaton explosion that they expected, they ended up with a 15 megaton explosion on the day. Everybody who was involved was utterly gobsmacked. Nobody had predicted it. I just think that's worth thinking through. How well do they really know what they're doing, if that's how far out they can get their estimations? But look, it's a dynamite, excuse the pun, documentary series on Netflix. So yeah, go and check it out if you have access to Netflix, or if you can access it by any other means. The Turning Point, the bomb, and the Cold War, just absolutely worth a look to get us all up to speed with the horror of nuclear weapons. One of the things that occurred to me, became very clear through watching Oppenheimer and doing a bit of background reading on that, was the question of at the Second World War for the Manhattan Project. Einstein went to the president and said, Roosevelt went to President Roosevelt and said, the Germans are producing a bomb. We need to have a response to this. Of course, the response that they picked on was to build their own bomb. So there was always this idea somehow that if the Americans and the Allies had a bomb, that they would somehow prevent the Germans from dropping their bomb. And when I think about it a bit, it's like, would the Germans have even known they had a bomb? How would they let the Germans know that they had this bomb? I mean, the only real option was a preemptive strike against the Germans with the bomb to show them? Or were they going to wait until after the Germans had tested their bomb? Where would the Nazis have tested their nuclear bomb if they had one? I'm guessing London, maybe Birmingham, maybe both. You know, if the Germans had succeeded in producing a bomb, by the time we were able to retaliate, there would have been nothing left of England, at least, of Britain, to save. Very little left of those two cities. One or the other, or both of them, would have been gone, in my guesstimation. Anyway, just think about what would the Germans have done with a bomb if they were needing to test it, if they had produced it. So how does our producing a bomb actually have any deterrent effect? The whole strategy of the Manhattan Project was that we should be able to retaliate after the fact, basically, that we would have some way of making the situation worse by nuking our enemies. Anyway, that's all speculation. What we do know is that the first 2 atom bombs were dropped on Japan at Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and that was a country which did not have a nuclear weapons program. It had not made any steps towards a nuclear weapons program, but it had made serious overtures towards surrendering. They were making their surrender conditional on being able to hold on to their emperor. But as far as actually having conditions go, it wasn't that they ended up with that anyway. So in the end, we dropped the bomb on Japan, and you know, there's this question of, oh, we would have to invade them. Well, not really, if they were going to surrender. And so why did we drop the bomb on the Japanese? Oh, well, maybe it was to threaten the Russians so that they would stop coming down from the north through, Korea and wherever else they were thought to be coming through. So if it was to stop the Russians, the problem with that logic was that in 1948, 3 years after the first atomic test on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, hundreds of thousands of people died. 75,000 or more people died in the short term in each of those incidents. The next step was 3 years later, the Russians had built a bomb. So where did the Russians get their bomb from? Oh, that's right. They got it. They used the design that the Americans had created, and the Allies had created. So the Russian bomb was impossible. It would not have happened if there wasn't a Manhattan Project which created the bomb in the US. The US paved the way for the Russians. They showed what would work. And the Russians then managed to steal those plans very quickly, almost immediately, managed to steal the plans and then produce their own their own nuclear weapon and test it. So the whole plan for nuclear safety and security has, demonstrably failed. It's been a totally failed experiment. And in fact, what it has left us with is this massive insecurity state, this massive militarized insecurity state, which people don't remember nowadays. People have forgotten that before World War II, this was not the way the world worked. We didn't live in this massive surveillance state where insecurity about national secrets was of such paramount importance to us all. We didn't have this infrastructure of internal spying and espionage around the world. There wasn't this Cold War constantly in progress. So I know people have different opinions on this, and I know there's been a lot of official work done to generate confusion about what the nuclear age has been about, it, telling us that it was an age of peace. But like, let's just get to the point where in the 1970s, the mid-70s, the late-70s, that each of the nuclear superpowers had 25,000 to 35,000 warheads ready to launch the press of a button, and that they came within moments of actually pressing that button. And the only thing that stopped them, both the Russians and the Americans on at least one occasion that we know of, the only thing that actually stopped them from going to all-out nuclear Armageddon was a colonel in each of their militaries on two separate incidents decided that they were not going to follow the protocol that was laid down for them, that they did not believe that the intel that was coming through to them, that this was actually the moment to press the button, and they refused to actually press those buttons. And those things saved us. In 1983, it was one of the Russians who refused to press the button. So it's the human factor that has saved us, not the system that was built around those nuclear weapons. It's the human refusal and disgust at these appalling weapons and the consequences of using them, which has essentially saved the human race from what may very well have been extinction, but certainly would have been being knocked back into the Stone Age by those the massive number of obscenely overpowered hydrogen bombs which could have been raining down on us back then. When I was at high school, when I was still listening to pop music on the radio and dancing around in my bedroom and trying to figure out what I was going to do with my life. So none of us might have had that life that we've had in the last 40-odd years if it weren't for those courageous souls who said no, who refused to follow those rules that were being laid down for them. Anyway, I think go and have a listen if you can, or go and have a look at the Turning Point documentary series on Netflix. Absolutely eye-opening, must-see television. Fantastically authoritative, clear, and compelling, truly compelling. Anyway, we have our own nuclear nut jobs here in Australia. There's the coalition have gone from being science deniers on climate to being science deniers on nukes. So it's not a big leap, I suppose. But anyway. Thank you for tuning in to another episode of the Environmental As Anything podcast. I'll be bringing them to you as regularly as I can. If you'd like to tune in to more of this kind of material, there's plenty of episodes available. You can subscribe to our podcast, and while you're there, you might as well rate it and help spread the word by sharing it on social media if you can. We're on social media, of course, on Facebook particularly. You can find us anywhere you look for Environmental As Anything. And if you're really keen to see the show carry on, please do go and support us on Patreon. Again, you can find us by just searching Environmental As Anything Patreon. Thank you for your support. Be gentle with yourselves, be kind to each other, and remember, we are all in this together.